Good morning. It's Election Day. What lessons will Democrats learn from elections across the country, from New York City to Virginia to New Jersey to California? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Famine is spreading in Sudan, including a city called Al-Fashir, where a paramilitary group has taken over. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. The UN says that group is committing genocide, an extension of atrocities committed 20 years ago. Also, as Congress fights over whether and how long to extend health care subsidies, who's fighting for the free market plan to reform the system and lower costs? It's Tuesday, November 4th. On this day in 1962, the U.S. made its last test of a nuclear weapon above ground, detonating a missile above a Pacific island. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Polls are opening this hour on the East Coast, including in Virginia and in New York. In New York City's mayoral race, President Trump has endorsed former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. Cuomo's running as an independent. He's opposing Democratic nominee Zohran Mamdani and Republican Curtis Sliwa. Cuomo's discounting the presidential endorsement, saying Trump is trying to beat Mamdani. Polls are opening now in New Jersey, too. From member station WNYC, Mike Hayes says New Jersey has seen a surge in early voting.
740,000 New Jerseyans voted early in person in this year's governor's race, according to the state's Division of Elections. That's more than triple the number of early voters from the 2021 governor's election. Combined with mail-in ballots, more than 1.2 million New Jerseyans voted before Election Day. Democrats hold a 280,000 vote advantage for ballots cast so far, but Republican strongholds in South Jersey saw some of the best early voting turnout, an indication that both parties are motivated to turn out this year. For NPR News, I'm Mike Hayes.
The Trump administration says it will restart federal food assistance funding cut off by the federal government shutdown. But officials say SNAP recipients will only get half of what they normally receive each month. A Democratic effort in the Senate to fully fund food assistance failed yesterday. Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer is blaming the Trump administration.
Everyone can get full benefits. The only person standing in the way is Donald Trump.
But Wyoming Republican Senator John Barrasso objected, calling the Democratic move a political stunt.
Want to end the food assistance cliff? It's easy. Pass the clean bipartisan continuing resolution. Democrats should vote for it immediately.
The White House is warning it will take a lot longer for people to get even the reduced SNAP benefits. Two men arrested last week in Michigan are now facing federal terrorism charges. Authorities say the pair are accused of plotting a potential ISIS-inspired attack for Halloween. NPR's Ryan Lucas reports.
The two defendants, Muhammad Ali and Majid Mahmoud, are charged by criminal complaint with receiving and transferring firearms to be used for a crime of terrorism. Court papers say the defendants had ISIS-related materials in their social media communications. The two men also allegedly purchased guns and practiced shooting with their purported co-conspirators at local shooting ranges. Investigators say they uncovered communications in which the defendants allegedly discussed an attack to take place on quote-unquote pumpkin, which officials believe was a reference to Halloween. Agents seized firearms, tactical vests, and ammunition during court-authorized searches of the men's homes, as well as a storage unit. A detention hearing is scheduled for next week. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR. Russian officials say Ukrainian drones have struck a petrochemical plant. That plant is about 1,000 miles away from the Ukrainian border, deep inside Russia. The plant makes rubber and jet fuel, and officials say the attack partially collapsed the plant's water treatment system. No casualties are reported. Comedian Jon Stewart has announced The Daily Show will continue for another year. NPR's Madali Del Barco reports Comedy Central renewed his contract.
Jon Stewart told his audience the news on last night's show.
The Daily Show will be coming back for another year.
Stewart will continue to be executive producer for the series through its 30th year, and he'll host the satirical news show every Monday through December of 2026.
We don't take for granted in any way how much your support means.
It's been a rocky road for late-night hosts. President Trump has lashed out against them for regularly mocking him and his policies. Earlier this year, CBS and parent company Paramount announced Stephen Colbert's Late Show is ending in May, and Disney briefly suspended Jimmy Kimmel's show over his controversial monologue that mentioned the killing of conservative activist Charlie Kirk. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News.
Renowned actor Diane Ladd has died at the age of 89. That's according to her daughter, actor Laura Dern, who says she was with her mother when she died in Ojai, California. Ladd was nominated for an acting Oscar 3 times for roles in Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, Wild at Heart, and for Rambling Rose. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at Cigna.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota history in 90 seconds.
June 1986, Dr. Derek Notman stared at a face thawed from the ice. The radiologists from Park Nicollet Medical Center in St. Louis Park had been sent to tiny Beachy Island, 745 miles from the North Pole, to help solve a 19th century mystery. In 1845, Sir John Franklin and 128 men had set sail from England to discover a northwest passage through the icebound waters north of present-day Canada. None of the men ever returned. But it was known that Franklin and his crew had made a winter camp on this island because 3 of them had died and been buried there. Notman and Larry Anderson, a Park Nicollet radiology tech, were in charge of taking x-rays of 2 of the disinterred bodies. After the bodies were painstakingly thawed, Notman and Anderson were finally able to clap eyes on the remarkably preserved, if distorted, faces of men who'd last breathed air 140 years ago. So how did they die? At the time, it was blamed on lead poisoning, but a later study would point the finger at plain old malnourishment.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Voting ends today in a handful of high-profile elections, including for mayor of New York City and for governor in New Jersey and Virginia.
It's a tradition to watch those 3 elections. They always come in the first year of a presidency, and people look for clues to what voters are thinking. This year, there's an extra big election to watch, a ballot measure in California that could influence who captures Congress next year.
Here to talk us through these races is NPR political correspondent Ashley Lopez. Ashley, good morning.
Good morning.
Let's start in California. It's a one-issue election, kind of unusual.
Yeah, kind of. It's a one-ballot measure on the ballot asking voters to allow state lawmakers to redraw their congressional map ahead of the 2026 election. California has an independent redistricting commission, which is something voters approved about 15 years ago. If passed, this measure would allow Democrats in the state to bypass that commission so that they can do a partisan gerrymander. That means they would draw up to 5 more seats that their party is favored to win in the midterms.
But you can't think about California in isolation here, because it's part of a national redistricting fight between Democrats and Republicans in a number of states. So in this case, this is Democrats in California responding to Republicans in Texas.
That's right. And Democrats went as far as saying that in the ballot language of this measure. Texas redrew its map at the request of President Trump and created 5 more favorable seats for Republicans in the state. And California basically wants to offset that edge that Trump wants. And this measure looks like it's likely to pass. I was actually in Southern California last week, and many Democratic voters told me they have like mixed feelings about bypassing the Independent Redistricting Commission and allowing gerrymandering, but they think it's more important to fight back against Trump and Republicans, and this is one way they can.
All right, let's move to the other coast, to New York City. What should we know about the mayoral race there?
Right. So the frontrunner for that race is Zohran Mamdani, who is 34 years old, and he's a member of the New York State Assembly. He won the Democratic primary this summer, which surprised a lot of folks because he was relatively unknown when he entered the race. And he beat a former governor in that primary contest, Andrew Cuomo. Cuomo decided to stay in the race by running as an independent. In the last days of the campaign, Cuomo has gotten some big endorsements, including the president's. But this hasn't been an easy fight for him. Mamdani has a very energetic grassroots campaign that has engaged a lot of young voters in the city, especially especially on affordability issues.
Also interesting that the president bypassed the Republican in the race to go to Cuomo as an independent. Okay, so what should we keep an eye on when it comes to the gubernatorial races in New Jersey and Virginia?
Yeah, so Democrats are out of power in Washington, obviously, but governorships have been this area of government where they've been able to somewhat push back against the Trump administration. So the stakes of these races are particularly high for Democrats. In Virginia, Democrats have a decent shot. Abigail Spanberger, a former member of Congress, is polling ahead in that race against Republican Lieutenant Governor Winsome Earle Sears. And there's a history of the party in power in the White House typically losing the race for governor in Virginia.
And what about New Jersey?
Yeah, I mean, that race might be a little tougher for the Democratic Party. Besides the polling being close, history is not on the party side like it is in Virginia. Voters have not elected the same party for governor for three terms in a row since the 60s. So Congresswoman Mikey Sherrill is seeking to defy that trend against Republican Jack Cittarelli.
So what if anything about tonight will you be looking for as a possible clue to the midterm elections next year?
Well, I'm going to be looking at how Democrats perform in these races. Yes, they're favored to win a lot of them, but there is a big difference among these candidates. Mamdani and Spanberger, for example, represent very different parts of the Democratic coalition. And results could tell us something about how voters are responding to different kinds of candidates and messaging as the party looks to next year.
That is NPR's Ashley Lopez. Ashley, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
The many voices we're hearing about this election include Faz Shakir. He is the chief political advisor of independent Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont. He directs the media organization More Perfect Union. He's come by Studio 31 this morning. We've got him some coffee with a little cream. Is that right? Did we get you? Is
Thank
it good?
You, Steve.
Okay.
Good to see you.
It's the staff who brought it by. Glad it's according to your order. So how will you read first the New York results?
Well, already Zora Mamdani has engineered a massive turnout. If you go back to the 2024 election, Steve, and you say what were the challenges of the Democratic Party and the Harris campaign, it's that they didn't mobilize traditional constituencies and get new voters into the voting booths. And it was one of the reasons why she didn't win. Here you have Zora Mamdani almost answering for the problem. He's in the primary and now in the general. If you look at the early vote turnout in New York, already engineering massive turnout, particularly among constituencies, people of color, young people who were least likely to vote in the last election cycle, and that's a good news.
There's a couple of different ways I could think about Mamdani's appeal, and one is he's a democratic socialist and he has a certain set of policies. But another way to think of him maybe is just that he's young and he's talented and different, and so he's interesting to younger people. Which do you think it is?
He's all of those, and he has an agenda that speaks affirmatively at a time when I think one of the struggles of the Democratic brand is what are you going to do if I put you into power? What are the answers to the solutions that you want to bring? Here comes Zora Mamdani saying, hey, buses fast and free, childcare universal, new grocery stores to service underserved populations. Here comes taxes that we tax more on the rich. These are affirmative visions of a society that we want to have. And I think Mamdani has tried to hopefully urge a lot of other Democrats to say, campaign on the back of something, not just against Donald Trump.
Just to be clear, you're saying these are not symbolic promises. People will expect him to deliver those exact things.
Thankfully, Mamdani is impressive in this way that he understood the tools that the mayor actually has. When he says freeze the rent, he knows that that's a power that the mayor has. When he talks about expanding bus lanes, that's something he has already done. So I think he's been grounded in what are the actual authorities that the mayor has and how can I use them to do something for you?
Although I think I just want to pause on this for a moment. I mean, the mayor does have the authority to freeze the rent. The city government messes with rent all the time in New York and the rent is still too damn high. I mean, rent control doesn't seem to have worked in New York City. Is there danger in making these promises that maybe you can't?
One of the challenges of a candidate at this moment, any candidate, is integrity. When you say you're going to fight for somebody, is it in your bones? Is it in your DNA? One of the reasons I think Mamdani is succeeding and so many people, Bernie Sanders is so popular right now, is that there's a sense that while corruption is all abound around us in politics, Trump is certainly leading the way and the most corrupt government we've seen in our modern lifetimes. Here comes people with integrity saying, we may disagree. But the North Star Solutions is improving your life. And know that when I'm in office, I won't forget about you. I am wholly focused on it. You can trust me.
I want to underline another aspect of this that I'm sure you're very familiar with. Mamdani has become a big star on Fox News, possibly the biggest star short of Sean Hannity. He's on all the time. People are warned about him continuously. He actually went on Fox News and took some questions, of course. But I'm curious if you think that kind of intense attention by Republicans helps him or hurts him.
Well, you know, nationally, it's a challenge because Zora Mamdani is a New York City mayoral candidate, and he has done a fantastic fantastic job of making himself aware to the people of New York City. Now, if you live in Nebraska, if you live in California, if you live in Arizona, you know, why does Zora Mamdani matter to you? Not much. But Fox News has decided, and the right has decided, well, I want to tell you that mm-hmm. this is scary, a scary proposition. And I suspect that one of the lessons that comes out of the Mamdani campaign is that people in Arizona, Nebraska, California will have to figure out the way that they speak to their own constituencies, that learn some lessons about the successes that Mamdani has had, both in how he's communicated, but the fact that he's got a substantive agenda that people believe and trust in and want desperately, especially as Trump, you know, leading our economy. I think right now his polling suggests that he's the least popular he's ever been on the economy, 70% disapproval.
Let me ask about that, because Trump is unpopular right now, and Democrats seem to be even more unpopular, and it's a close race, at least in New Jersey. We don't know what's going to happen there. Does it bother you the Democrats have not been able to take so much advantage of Trump's unpopularity?
We'll see. I mean, you know, you'll find out what the results of this were. If you look at 2024 election, Kamala Harris wins both of those states by 6 points. Mm-hmm. So that's the baseline heading into this election cycle. If you go back to how we did in the first Trump term, you know, Virginia, I think the gubernatorial candidate there was a Democrat, Ralph Northam. He won by 9 points. You know, in New Jersey, they won by double digits in Trump's first term. So I think you can overperform the baselines of +6 if that's the way you're looking at it.
I guess I'm just thinking Democrats don't seem to have a very coherent national message at this point.
Yes, you're right. And, you know, that's one of my pet challenges and problems and frustrations right now, is that you should go into this election cycle saying, here's 3, 4, 5 things that we as Democrats want to do. That said, there's an energy and enthusiasm out there among the public that is incredible. Already in Trump's second term, you're seeing more activism and action and grassroots engagement than you did in Trump's first term.
Faz Shakir, Chief Political Advisor to Bernie Sanders, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve. Good to see you.
A federal court has restored some of those federal benefits for food known as SNAP that were cut during the government shutdown. It comes as top Trump officials have started claiming the entire program is corrupt. NPR's Jude Jaffe Block reports.
Over the past few days, Secretary of Agriculture Brooke Rollins has started pushing the message that federal food aid is filled with fraud. Here she is on Fox News on Sunday.
We sent letters to every governor in America being very clear that no illegal aliens can use SNAP. 0, 0, 0.
But people in the country illegally have never been eligible for SNAP. In that same interview, Rollins spoke about USDA's controversial demand that states turn over the personal data of all SNAP recipients. Multiple lawsuits have challenged that demand, but nearly 30 mostly Republican states did turn over data for millions of people.
We have found thousands and thousands of illegal use of the EBT card. We have been moving people off of SNAP. We've got almost 700,000 people, I think, we've moved off just since the president took office. We've arrested about 118 people.
Some in the pro-Trump media space quickly reported that the alleged fraud was committed by immigrants in the country illegally. Rollins didn't actually make that specific claim, though she alluded to it on X. Tracy Roof says this is part of a larger rhetorical strategy by the Trump administration.
I mean, the same thing is being done with Medicaid, to say that Democrats are trying to provide coverage to all these illegal immigrants, which it's not.
Roof studies SNAP as a political scientist at the University of Richmond. While Rollins has suggested there's something suspicious about SNAP's expansion in recent years, Roof says it's actually because
the high prices for food and the fact that a lot of people just can't stretch their dollars from their incomes enough to be able to feed their families.
Roof also says the number Rollins gave need a lot more context. For example, the 700,000 people who were taken off the program may no longer be eligible due to Congress's recent cuts to SNAP. Jude Jaffe Block, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
This is Drew Miller from Boiled and Lead urging you to support KAXE and KBXE. Community radio is a lifeline for culture, and these days it's under threat. If you enjoy it, you need to help pay for it because nobody else is going to do it except for you. Please support KAXE and the Summer Pledge Drive.
Make a donation now by visiting our website, kaxe.org, and clicking the word donate, or text donate to 218-326-1234.
My lover was climbing up that old gallows ladder, cried out so gaily for his high white cap and feather. I've always been a lively lad, never murdered.
NPR comes from this station and from American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org. From Fidelity Investments, a dedicated advisor can help build a comprehensive wealth plan. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. And from the NPR Wine Club, now shipping to additional states. Whether purchasing a few wines or joining the wine club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. At the heart of the government shutdown is a fight over health insurance, specifically how much it should cost buyers who use the government-run marketplace set up under the Affordable Care Act. Along with the lawmakers who've been fighting about this, we've been talking to health policy experts about whether the ACA has been a good way to get people access to health insurance, but also why is health care so expensive in the U.S. anyway? Last week, we heard from Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel. He's considered one of the architects of the ACA, who said it has fixed the main problem it was designed to solve, getting more people access to coverage. Today, we hear a different perspective from Michael Cannon. He says the ACA has failed and it's time for something different. He's the director of health policy studies at the Cato Institute. That's a libertarian think tank based in Washington, D.C. And he's with us now. Good morning. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning.
You know, many advanced countries have solved the issue of access with single payer systems. What's wrong with single payer systems from your perspective?
Well, first, they take away your right to make your own health decisions by saying you got to give your money to the government and keep giving your money to the government, even if the government's doing a lousy job. The second problem is the government is doing a lousy job. No country has solved the problem of making healthcare more universal. Many of them have issued a blanket guarantee of access to care, but that's not the same as actually delivering access to care. If what we want is to make healthcare more universal, then what we need are innovations that drive down the price so that more people can afford it by themselves. And Congress has shown over and over again that it is completely incapable of eliminating wasteful health spending. We have the most expensive health sector in the world. And every time someone identifies a problem with it, like Obamacare premiums rising at 26%, people say, well, the only solution is to throw another $500 billion at it.
Okay. You've told us what's wrong with the system as you see it. What is your better idea?
The biggest problem with the U.S. health sector right now is that we're spending $5 or $6 trillion per year, but the wrong people are controlling the money. It's the government and employers, and if we took that money and gave it to consumers, we would see prices falling, healthcare becoming more universal. There are experiments that show this. Let them choose a health plan that stays with them between jobs, because then people will have seamless coverage throughout life changes.
You know, one person's unhelpful, burdensome regulatory requirement is another person's essential, right? Like contraceptive care, assisted reproductive technologies, preventive care, cancer screenings.
The question is not whether there should be access to effective screenings. The question is, what is the best process for identifying what the cost-effective screenings are and then getting the price down as far as we can so that it's most widely available, most universal. I think that if we did what I suggested, just let consumers control their health insurance dollars and choose their own health plan, you would have health plans competing to do both of those things.
Before we let you go, we've been talking to Democrats and Republicans, as I said. We've spoken to a number of Republicans over the course of this, and many of them have diagnosed the problem in the same way that you have. They haven't really put forward any specific solution. So why is it that the Republicans have not produced a coherent strategy, including things that one would think that they would support, that lean on free market solutions.
There just are no, there's no Bernie Sanders of free market healthcare. There's no AOC of free market healthcare. I think it's because healthcare in the United States government has already socialized it so much that making any effort to limit government's involvement is easy to demagogue as taking healthcare away from grandma or something like that. And Republicans haven't invested the time to get their heads around exactly why that's wrong and why reducing the government's role would actually make healthcare more universal and higher quality.
That is Michael Cannon. He is the Director of Health Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. That's a libertarian think tank based in Washington, D.C. Michael Cannon, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Many civilian employees on military bases are working without pay during the government shutdown. Michelle Corum of our member station WJCT reports on one local business trying to help people who work on bases near Jacksonville, Florida.
A1A Highway in Atlantic Beach is lined with self-storage facilities, a used car lot, barber shops, and Pie Heaven Bakery Cafe.
Hey.
Nice to see you.
What you doing?
Inside, customers get a familiar greeting from owner Anita Hyde. The shop is bursting with the scent of apples and cinnamon and savory chicken pot pie. For the past few weeks, Hyde has seen worry grow among this military community as the government shutdown drags on.
We're right down the street from the base. It just doesn't make sense that we wouldn't do something.
The base she's talking about is Naval Station Mayport with about 2,000 civilian employees. So she decided to give away free chicken pot pies.
To the families that aren't getting paid, if they're having to show up for work anyway.
Word spread quickly. She heard from firefighters on base. They are government workers not getting paid.
A few of them called in and they said, okay, there's like 17 of us on duty right now. And can we take advantage of this? I said, you betcha. Get in here.
Also here to collect a free pie is Miranda Bossy. She's a federal employee on another nearby base and called ahead to reserve her pie. She's also the mother of a young son. Her last paycheck was October 1st, and she's grateful to the bakery.
Because I'm a single mom. I have him, so I had to defer my mortgage. I had to defer my truck payment and all that. So it really sucks, you know?
She says she had to get creative without a paycheck.
Eating like pantry food, like canned food, trying to make meals out of that. Not eating out, because we used to eat out every now and then.
It's people like Bossy who are stressed right now that Anita Hyde and her crew of nine want to bake for.
And the one thing a chicken pot pie is, it's comfort food. If you don't know what you're going to do for dinner tonight, you know, at least we got you there.
To her surprise, other customers have stepped up with contributions that cover her baking supplies. So for now, the free chicken pot pie offer for those working without pay still stands. For NPR News, I'm Michelle Corum in Atlantic Beach, Florida.
Hey, thanks for listening to your public radio station, which brings you stories like that, sharing news about what's happening all across this country. Reporters, editors, producers at those stations are members of your community. They cover your community, they help the world know more about your community, and they are supported by the community. They're also accountable to the community. This public radio station is where you can get it all. This is NPR News.
Poet Kate Baer's new collection takes on the tension and abundance of midlife.
You're kind of holding both the feeling of I've never felt more rich and fuller and beautiful and like who I am, while also facing my own mortality.
I'm Elsa Chang. Kate Baer on her latest book of poetry. It's called How About Now? On the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tune in for All Things Considered coming up this afternoon at 4 o'clock. It's here on KAXE. We are people powered. We thank you for supporting KAXE, a local station that brings you information like what you can find right now at our website, kaxe.org. There are School districts all across our region, today is voting day, and there are referendums out there. 13 school districts, in fact, in rural northern Minnesota are asking residents to support the referendums in special elections this year. Find out what school districts, the information behind it, and how to vote at KAXE.org. I'm Heidi Holton. Thanks for being with me this morning. We've got a lot of nature reporting for you coming up. And at 8:40, we're going to be talking about fire and keeping your land and home safe from fire dangers. Coming up on Headwaters at 9 a.m. today, it'll be Brainerd folk musician Kelly Smith. Your host will be Malachi Coons. He's talking with Kelly about the upcoming grassroots concert series in Nisswa. Smith is the new artistic director for the series, which began back in 1988. And if you are someone who loves music, and if you've always wanted to be an on-air volunteer DJ at KAXE, we have fall training coming up Wednesday, November 12th at KAXE, or join us in Bemidji at KBXE on Thursday, November 13th. Both classes run from 5:30 to 7. Email dgannon at kaxe.org for more information or to confirm your attendance. Coming up is your daily dose of phenology. We're expecting a slight chance of rain early today, then cloudy. Highs 50 to 54 with light southeast winds. Overnight temperatures in the low to mid 30s with a slight chance of rain.
On this date, November 4th, 1995, Crooked Lake, the lake that I live on, froze over completely for the first time of the year. November 4th is pretty early on the scale of things, even by the old records. November 4th was a pretty early freeze-up for Crooked Lake. Not that I complained. I was out skating as soon as there were 2 inches of ice on it. But over the years, Crooked Lake has decreased its freeze-up date from early November, usually averaging around the 8th of November, to now, 30 years on, it's freezing up about the 25th or 26th of November. So it's averaged about a half a day a year later over the last 30 years. Now, that's not every year it's a half a day later. It's just that the average, if you take 10-year segments, the last 10 years, the average is much closer to the 25th than to the 8th, which it was in the first 10 years.
In 2018, I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. A famine in Sudan has spread.
That is according to an organization that monitors hunger around the world. The famine is one effect of a war. In recent days, an armed group that's battling the government captured a city called Al-Fashir in the Darfur region. The Rapid Support Forces, as they are called, allegedly moved into the city, killed many people, and put the rest in danger.
NPR's Emmanuel Akinmotu has been covering this story. Emmanuel, welcome back.
Good morning.
Okay, first, what does the finding by this outside group suggest about the scale of the suffering here?
Well, what we know is that about 375,000 more people are suffering famine, and many of those people are in Darfur, and that's the area controlled by the Rapid Support Forces, or the RSF. That's the group at war with the government, and they include people in Al-Fashir, the city Michelle mentioned. And the catastrophic situation there really isn't a surprise. It was under siege by the RSF for a year and a half, and about 250,000 people living there were almost completely cut off from food and medical supplies, and community kitchens that were really a lifeline providing food funded by donations, they were bombed. People have been forced to eat animal feed, even hides.
Wow. So what more can you say then about these hundreds of thousands of people with very little to eat?
Well, there's been a communications blackout, so it's very difficult to get a detailed picture of events, but information that has trickled out is really shocking. Only about 70,000 people have fled, according to the UN, and less than 10,000 of them are actually accounted for. Most of those who've managed to escape have fled to a remote mountainous town about 25 miles away called Tawila. The majority of them are women, and organizations that have been supporting them, they say several have witnessed their children, their husbands, members of their family gunned down and tortured. There are reports of people being asked what ethnic group they are and then killed, and descriptions of hundreds of people at a time, mostly men, rounded up and executed.
Okay, so the people accused of doing all of this, the actors, the group that took over the city, the Rapid Support Forces, they're this group that was under the auspices of the government, then turned against the government. They're allegedly supported by the United Arab Emirates, which is a big foreign policy player throughout the region. What are they saying about these accusations against them?
Well, firstly, the RSF, they've denied targeting civilians. But what we've repeatedly seen during the war is that these abuses and atrocities really are systemic and part and parcel of how they've operated. The UN says they're committing a genocide in Darfur, again, against African ethnic groups, and that's 20 years after the first Darfur genocide. And really, this wave of violence is an extension of that. And then, as you've mentioned, there's the UAE, and they're a close ally of the US who are facing growing attention for their role in this war. A few days ago, Anwar Gargash, a senior Emirati official, he commented on the situation in Al-Fashir.
Right now, as we condemn the atrocities in Al-Fashir, and they deserve condemnation, and they deserve also for us to condemn every other also atrocity in Sudan.
And really, he spoke about it in humanitarian terms, talking about the need for more aid and the need for a ceasefire, but he didn't address widespread allegations that the UAE are arming the RSF.
I'm just thinking about everything you've told me here, Emmanuel, and a phrase that is sticking with me is genocide again. We're talking about a region that has already suffered genocide, and it's suffering it again.
Exactly. And you know, many of the people in Darfur would say the violence really has been continuing in the interim, but it's exploded during the civil war. And it's an incredibly bleak situation there.
NPR's Emmanuel Akinmotu, thanks so much.
Thanks, Steve.
Tuberculosis is the world's deadliest infectious disease. More than 3,000 people around the world die from TB every day, and many tuberculosis patients live in low-income countries with limited access to health care. Now, artificial intelligence is being used where medical specialists are not available, part of a trend that some experts say will change the future of global health. NPR's Gabrielle Emmanuel reports.
Carrying an X-ray machine and a computer, Jakite Lansina travels around Mali in West Africa, going from clinic to clinic. He's a technician for a local nonprofit, Arcade Santé Plus. On a recent morning, he called me as he headed into a community health center.
Outside, there is a lot of people. They're coming from everywhere.
One of the people is a mother. She's coughing a lot, and like the others in line, she's here to see if she has TB. She stands in front of Lansina's X-ray machine. He snaps an image, and almost instantly, it's read by AI. His computer displays a picture that looks like a heat map, where blue is good and red is bad.
Where you see the red means this part is not good.
AI says the mom has TB. Lencina gets a sputum sample to send to a lab to confirm. Then he quickly sends the mom home to get her kids so he can test them, too. 3 of the 5 kids also have TB. Soon, they'll start a 6-month course of antibiotics. Lencina says this technology has revolutionized their approach because instead of taking a week or two to get an answer, they get one instantly and without a doctor in the room. Peter Sands heads the Global Fund, a multi-billion dollar effort to tackle TB and other diseases.
We're talking about situations like refugee camps in Chad. There are no radiologists. So who gets to look at the thing and say, is there a problem here or not? Well, actually, AI does. It's brilliant.
In the past 4 years, the Global Fund has put almost $200 million into AI-enabled TB screenings. Sands points to a significant increase in the number of TB cases detected in that time. At MIT, Professor Regina Barzilai builds these AI models. She's predicting AI will be widely adopted in low-income countries where there is a shortage of doctors and specialists.
AI is going to be adopted much more faster in developing countries because they have serious unmet need.
But some are urging caution. Erwin John Carpio is with the Philippines College of Radiology. He says many high-income countries like the U.S. have regulations and guardrails for using AI in health. In the U.K., he says if an AI model misses a diagnosis, it's officially reported. But that's not the case for many low- and middle-income countries like the Philippines.
In our country, since we don't have the laws in place yet, vendors are not required to provide information like that.
Carpio says because each population is a bit different, the AI model must be calibrated to fit the local context. And he says there should be continual quality control checks.
You're going to need a computer scientist, a data scientist, an AI engineer. You're going to need an entire team of experts.
The program used by the clinic in Mali does have those human experts backing it up. Under those circumstances, Carpio admits AI can do a good job with health screenings. But he doesn't want our enthusiasm for the technology to race ahead of our vigilance in making sure we use it responsibly. Gabriella Emanuel, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Debuting on October 16th, KEXE brings you a brand new podcast, Season Watch, exploring the seasonal wonders of life in northern Minnesota. Voices like Charlie Mitchell, John Latimer, and our listeners. Find it on most podcast platforms. Season Watch is a podcast for those who are curious about the changes in nature. Thanks for tuning in. This is Morning Edition from National Public Radio here on the independent, people-powered KAXE. We've got local news coming up with the Up North Report. That is coming up at 7:01 this morning. And make sure you check out our website for the latest local news in our region. Go to KAXE.org. That includes stories about an Alexandria developer who's proposing a $22.5 million hotel for Bemidji's rail corridor. Our reporter Larissa Donovan has the story. Taking a look at our weather for this Tuesday, slight chance of rain early, then cloudy, highs 50 to 54 and light southeast winds, overnight temperatures in the low to mid 30s with a slight chance of rain, sunny tomorrow with highs 46 to 50 degrees. Our question of the week, it is the week of opening deer hunting season for firearms. We want to hear about your hunting traditions or your stories to share. You can text 218-326-1234. Whether you're a hunter, whether you always do something special in these weeks, we'd love to hear from you. Each week, we gather stories and get a little more connected when we hear from each other. Don't forget about the brand new podcast, Season Watch, Nature Nerds Unite. Find it at KEXC.org.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping those in need is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Walk into any store. A bottle of Tylenol will cost you a few bucks. We also know the price tag for the company that makes Tylenol, almost $49 billion. Consumer products giant Kimberly-Clark said Monday it was buying Kenvue, which makes Tylenol, and also Band-Aids and Listerine. Why is this deal happening now, especially after President Trump said, quote, taking Tylenol is not good? Trump blames the drug for causing autism without clear scientific evidence that it does. I'm going to ask Aaron Lash, Director of Consumer Equity Research at Morningstar, which is an investment research company. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So why would Kimberly-Clark want to buy Kenvue right now?
Growth across the consumer product space has been quite tepid of late. It's been very difficult to drive volumes given the financial constraints consumers are under. And so this could be a mechanism through which to try to drive that growth.
Did Kimberly-Clark get a good deal because Kenvue stock fell after Trump's comments about Tylenol?
Kenvue stock has been troubled for some time. Mm-hmm. Since Kenvue was spun out from Johnson & Johnson 2 years ago, the business has really been challenged to operate as an independent organization. It has a solid brand portfolio, but they haven't been able to effectively compete as an independent organization. And so, yes, this has been a business that's been in a turnaround, and thus we do think that Kimberly got a fair price for this business.
Why have they struggled to function as an independent entity?
When you're combined with a healthcare arm of Johnson & Johnson that's obviously incredibly large and powerful in its own right, being separate and having to compete with other behemoths in the consumer product space like Procter & Gamble, like Colgate and Unilever, businesses that have operated independently, understand the routes to market, how to work with their retail partners, the importance of innovation and marketing, the importance of data and analytics on consumers. All of that is something that wasn't maybe fully appreciated at Kenvue as it was at their singularly focused, nationally branded peers across the consumer product space.
Well, you know, Johnson & Johnson has been the target of multiple lawsuits alleging its baby powder had asbestos, and Johnson & Johnson is covering Kenvue's liability in those cases. But is this still an issue? Is this an issue for Kimberly-Clark as the buyer?
I think that there still is litigation risk, even if not from a financial perspective for Kimberly-Clark. There is that overhang on shares that could persist as long as the issues around talc and Tylenol persist.
Could a purchase like this help Tylenol's brand reputation? Hard to assess whether it's been damaged or not by the president's comments because, you know, people take his comments in all different kinds of ways. But what do you think?
I think that in aggregate, thinking about the Kenvue brand portfolio, I think it could be advantageous to be within the Kimberly umbrella. Kimberly has a very focused portfolio across diapers, adult care, and feminine care, and bringing in other personal care categories can drive further insights around category reach and consumer trends and preferences that could aid their brand portfolio.
And quickly, what about for consumers? Do you think prices will rise? I think that's the question most of us would have.
I don't think that prices will rise. There isn't a direct overlap between any of the categories that they really play in, so we don't expect higher prices.
All right, that's Aaron Lash, who's Director of Consumer Equity Research at Morningstar. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
You should give as you are able, because the need is immediate.
Longtime KAXE contributor and Minnesota Star Tribune columnist Aaron Brown. We talked about recent cuts to public media.
It's the people here who make it go. If you want a nice, independent, completely northern Minnesota media source that isn't beholden to anybody else, you have to be willing to put in a little bit of money. This is the time. This is the moment when we have to make decisions about what really is important to our community and to ourselves.
I'm Jennifer Barr. Give right now at KAXE.org. Thank you for your support.
Whitewater rapids of changing tariffs for businesses that get parts from overseas.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Odoo, offering software that provides building blocks for creating a custom software suite. Odoo, what businesses need.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. In a test over limits to a president's power to act without Congress, oral arguments are set for tomorrow in the U.S. Supreme Court over a subset of the Trump administration's import taxes, the ones dubbed reciprocal tariffs. Ahead of that, we continue to talk to businesses benefiting or losing out to the highest U.S. tariffs since the 1930s. Today, not your grandfather's folding camp chair. It's a Pennsylvania-based business with a global supply chain called True Places. The chairs are pricier than most, and I will say nicer than most, like for camping or tailgating, that kind of thing. Ben Knepler is co-founder. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So look, there was a long stretch some years ago where a U.S.-based company could set up a supply chain somewhere in the world and set it and forget it. Like, you could have that relationship for years. You've had to, I think, refine your supply chain, what, quite a bit in recent years?
When we started the company, the entire category of this kind of product is all made in Asia, primarily in China. From the beginning, we were trying to figure out alternatives to that. Last year, we finally found a viable alternative in Cambodia, so outside of China. It took us about a year to move and transition our manufacturing from China to Cambodia. And then, we've been getting hit with a lot more tariffs again this year.
Yeah, with the shifting tariff landscape, Cambodia, there's a tariff that is now a lot higher than it was to start the year, right?
In the last 6 months, the tariff rate on products like we make in Cambodia coming into the U.S. has gone from 0% to 49% to 10% to 36% to 19%, plus all kinds of other threats and other tariffs. So it's really impossible to plan when you've got no idea what that's going to look like tomorrow.
Ben, would you manufacture in, for instance, Pennsylvania, you know, in the United States, if the numbers worked out? Shorter supply chains would minimize the risk.
Of course, if we could, we would. But the manufacturing for our category of products just doesn't even exist in the U.S. So we'd have to create all of these interconnected supply chains that don't currently exist. If they did exist, the cost would be orders of magnitude higher.
And to be clear, you have U.S. employees. It's just they're not actually making the chairs.
That's the irony of this situation is that we're a U.S. company. We do pretty much everything in the U.S. except for just the manufacturing and assembling of our chairs. You know, if we go out of business, then all of those other businesses that we do those other functions with in the U.S. Also get hit.
Are you watching this Supreme Court case at all? Because it's a chance, right, that some of these tariffs are ruled illegal and the numbers change again.
I think the general feeling, speaking to other business owners and other founders and others in the industry, is that even if it's ruled illegal in this case, this administration will find other ways to get to the similar kind of outcome. We've seen over the past few months the exact rules and the tariff rates change on an almost daily basis. And so this court case feels consequential on the one hand, but also feels just like another change that we don't know where it's ultimately going to end up or just continue changing over time.
Ben Knepler, co-founder of the Pennsylvania outdoor chair company True Places, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Again, tariffs are import taxes that raise money for the Treasury. Marketplace with Kai Ryssdal later today will have special coverage, including what happens if all that money from reciprocal tariffs goes away, if the high court were to find those were essentially ill-gotten gains. Marketplace on public radio stations nationwide or streaming from the marketplace.org page. Let's do the numbers this morning, looking down. Yeah, Dow futures down 0.7%, but S&P futures are down 1%. NASDAQ futures are down 1.3%. 2.5 hours here before stock markets open in earnest. A lot of artificial intelligence stocks are droopy this morning. The Trump administration has responded to a court order ordering the U.S. government to use emergency funds to pay partial food stamp benefits for November. In a filing yesesterday, the administration said more than $4 billion in emergency funds would cover about half of the monthly payments for the approximately 42 million Americans who rely on food aid. It's unclear when the payments will land for struggling families.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by The Economist, introducing The Economist Insider, a new video offering with twice-weekly shows featuring in-depth analysis and expertise. More at economist.com/insider. And by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at schwab.com.
Elon Musk got some bad news from a huge investor today. Norway's massive sovereign wealth fund has voted against Musk's pay package. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
Tesla is scheduled to hold its annual meeting this Thursday, but shareholders can cast their ballots early on things like the nearly $1 trillion pay package Tesla wants to give Elon Musk. Musk would have to increase Tesla's value to $8.5 trillion to get the raise. Tesla says the pay package is, quote, designed to retain Elon for years to come. Norway's sovereign wealth fund says it voted against the proposal, though, because it was concerned about the total size of the award. It also says Tesla didn't do anything to mitigate what it called key person risk, that is, a situation where a company depends too much on one person, in this case, Elon Musk. The fund says it will continue to seek constructive dialogue with Tesla. It owns a little more than 1% of the company, a stake worth more than $11 billion. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Our producers are Tamar Fagan, Ashley Rodriguez, Ariana Rosas, and Erica Soderstrom. Our senior producer is Alex Schroeder. Our supervising senior producer is Meredith Gerritsen-Morby. In Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio. This is the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
News headlines are coming up from National Public Radio's Morning Edition, but this is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. We receive support from North Homes Children and Family Services. They provide mental health care in Minnesota. November is National Adoption Awareness Month, highlighting the need for adoptive and foster care families. North Homes provides licensing and case management for those opening their heart and home. More information is available at northhomes.org. Slight chance of rain early today, then highs 50 to 54 and overnight temperatures in the low to mid 30s. Sun tomorrow with highs 46